Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgift.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Yesterday, the 21st of May, marked the 90th anniversary of a very significant milestone in human history. It was on May 21st, 1927, that a pilot by the name of Charles A. Lindbergh landed a small monoplane called the Spirit of St. Louis in Paris, having completed an extraordinary 3,600-mile solo journey across the North Atlantic. Only 500 people were there when he took off. A crowd of more than 100,000 were on hand for his dramatic touchdown in Paris. And with that flight, Charles Lindbergh achieved what had seemed to be utterly impossible and became one of the greatest heroes of his or any age. Dan Hampton, the author of several different best-selling books, has just written a book called The Flight, Charles Lindbergh's Daring and Immortal 1927 Transatlantic Crossing. He sets Charles Lindbergh's flight in proper historic context, talking about the technology of the day and its limitations, talking about the competition for the $25,000 Ortaig Prize, which is what prompted Lindbergh to undertake this perilous journey. What Dan Hampton does not do in the book is go on to explore any of the controversies which dogged Charles Lindbergh later in his life, and also does not really explore the tragedy that occurred in the early 1930s when Charles Lindbergh's young baby was abducted and ultimately murdered. This book is about the flight itself. In fact, it is a meticulous account, nearly minute by minute, of what that flight was like and how Charles Lindbergh was able to accomplish such a thing. The book is published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins, and includes fascinating photographs and diagrams that help us understand just what ensued on that extraordinary journey across the Atlantic. The book, again, is called The Flight, Charles Lindbergh's Daring and Immortal 1927 Transatlantic Crossing. So, Mr. Hampton, explain who had come close to doing what Charles Lindbergh ultimately accomplished in 1927. There had been pilots who had accomplished nearly the same thing, but not quite the same thing. Say a word about that.
Yeah, there were the Atlantic had been crossed successfully. The first one that I know about was back in 1919. Actually, the U.S. Navy did it the way the military usually does things. They over-engineered a bit. They had three flying boats, and they had warships every 50 miles across the Atlantic from Newfoundland to the Azores with searchlights, so the planes could fly at night. And they, like I said, they were flying boats, so if they came down in the water, it was okay. And out of the three that started, one of them made it all the way to England. Not practical for commercial purposes, but the military proved that it, in fact, it could be done. And then a couple of British pilots, Alcott and Brown, took off from Newfoundland and landed, so to speak, in Ireland. So they flew across maybe 2,000 miles of ocean, but they did not fly nonstop from New York to Paris, which was the point of the Ortaig Prize that Lindbergh was trying for. It had to be from Paris to New York or New York to Paris nonstop.
And, of course, that would be for a grand prize of $25,000 if someone was able to do that. Do we know exactly how many attempts were made to win that Ortaig Prize?
Well, the most prominent one was actually there were several, but the most prominent one happened just a few weeks before Lindbergh took off. Two Frenchmen, Charles Nungesser and Coley, took off from Paris coming the other way. And they were both well-known aviators. They were, World War I veterans. They were highly experienced, very glamorous, typical French, very, very flamboyant, excellent pilots and navigators. And they disappeared without a trace somewhere between Ireland and probably Nova Scotia. Nobody ever knew what happened to them. So Lindbergh had that hanging over his head.
Mm-hmm. Explain the state of the technology that Charles Lindbergh was using. Of course, flight itself had not existed all that long. But I think it's important for us to understand just how primitive this technology was. There, of course, had been some breakthroughs during the First World War in particular, but we're still talking about a very primitive aircraft compared to today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his plane was basically a steel frame, carbon steel frame with a wood inner structure, glued wood just like they'd used in the First World War, and then it was covered with cotton, Pima cotton that had been lacquered, varnished, so to speak, with acetate dope. So it was really a flimsy little airplane. It had a magnificent engine in it, though. The Wright Whirlwind engine was probably the best one of its time, which if you only have one and you're going to fly across the Atlantic, that's what you want. The biggest limitation for him were his navigational instruments. We still hadn't progressed beyond the compass stage and wouldn't for some time. And so he had a couple of different compasses, both of which were subject to magnetic storms, disruption, mechanical problems, all sorts of things. So, he knew that as long as he flew east, he'd hit Europe some point, but he wasn't exactly sure where. And I would say that, combined with all of his twisting and turning through the night to avoid weather, he really did not have a good idea of where he was when the sun came up on May 21st.
Wow. One thing that was quite a revelation to me as I read your fascinating book was the fact that the primitive nature of his aircraft, and it wasn't exceptionally primitive for its day. I suppose in some ways it was a fairly typical aircraft, but very primitive compared to what someone would fly today. But that there was in a sense, hidden advantage to that. That is, that it was helped him stay awake. You write at one point, now more than ever, Slim, his nickname, is glad the plane isn't too easy to fly, that it is constantly requiring hands and feet on the controls. So in other words, he more easily could have fallen asleep during this long, long flight if the plane had been, in a sense, more modern and easier to fly.
Yeah, absolutely. And he fell asleep anyway, a couple of times. It's unavoidable. I mean, the longest I ever flew without a break was about 15 hours, and that was miserable enough in a single-seat, fighter where you can't get up and move around and go get a drink or go to the bathroom or anything. And, he flew twice that long in a plane, a cockpit that was roughly the same size. And he purposely didn't want it easy to fly, as you mentioned, because he figured, rightly so, that it would help keep him awake. And it did. If he took his hands and feet off the controls within a few seconds, it would begin to wander. There was no autopilot, the way we think of it anyway. So he had to stay awake to physically fly, which is another reason why he went alone. If you had another pilot with you, you would tend to rely on him. Plus, he figured he'd sacrificed 180 pounds worth of fuel, which he thought he needed. So he wanted to do it alone for all those reasons.
Right. Explain the level of attention which this attempt received from press both here and abroad.
Oh, it was astonishing, and he didn't see that coming. I don't think Raymond Ortiz saw it coming either. But it's roughly similar, I think, to the hysteria that accompanied, the first flights into outer space, maybe even the first space shuttle. This was an unknown frontier, the largest at the time. Nobody had ever flown across the Atlantic before, and aviation captured people's imaginations. It still does now, even though it's relatively commonplace. And for him to do this, I mean, the world just went, they went crazy, you know, because this as they saw it, was the last frontier and it had been crossed.
Ahead of him successfully completing this, what was the tenor of press coverage? I mean, was it a very optimistic kind of coverage, or was there a sense of dread just beneath the surface that Lindbergh was likely to fail as others had failed?
Yeah, there was a lot of that, and you know, and for good reason. You know, the two Frenchmen had disappeared. René Fonck, who'd been another French aviator, had crashed right where Lindbergh took off from. You know, he'd crashed a plane on takeoff. Two American naval aviators had died the month before, taking off on a test flight prior to crossing the ocean. So there was a lot of that, and then he was the only guy to try it alone, and so people, all the naysayers came out. You know, there's always people that will tell you can't do it, and they figured, well, he's young, he's inexperienced, he's trying this alone, you know, he's definitely going to die. So there was a lot of that.
Well, fortunately, of course, Lindbergh does not die. He is successful, and the accomplishment is greeted with nothing short of delirium. I so appreciate that you wrote this book in such a way that even though anybody reading it, of course, knows that he succeeds, it still reads like a thriller or a suspense novel. I wonder if you could say a word as we close about the name of Harry Wheeler. The story of Harry Wheeler on the ground in France really just gives us a little idea of the delirium that greeted Lindbergh when he landed.
Yeah, you know, and you'll have to read the readers will have to read it to get the full story. But basically, the French had a plan to help Lindbergh, you know, basically protect him. And they had a double lined up that they were going to give his hat and coat to so that they could get him away from the crowd. That didn't work out right, and poor old Harry Wheeler was just standing there, and he ended up catching Lindbergh's helmet. And the fact that he was an American, he was blonde, you know, at midnight, you know, at 10:30 at night, you know, in Paris on a dark field, I guess they thought he was Lindbergh, especially since he's carrying the helmet. And so they, you know, they mangled him. I mean, not on purpose. They were very enthusiastic, but they, you know, they basically kidnapped him and carried him around on their shoulders, and he even had a hard time convincing the U.S. ambassador that he wasn't Charles Lindbergh.
Well, we can read more about that extraordinary scene and much more in your fascinating book, again called The Flight, Charles Lindbergh's Daring and Immortal 1927 Transatlantic Crossing, published by William Morrill, complete with fascinating photographs. Dan Hampton, great to reconnect with you, and congratulations on this superb book.
My pleasure. I'll come back anytime. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. And now I want to read a portion of Dan Hampton's book to you, a portion of Chapter 1, which is called The First Hours. Roosevelt Field, Long Island, May 20th, 1927, 7:50 a.m. Glue and gasoline. The snug cockpit reeked, but the pilot ignored both smells. Slowly pushing the throttle forward, he brought the roaring engine to its takeoff revolutions. The frame shook as the aircraft strained against the wheel chocks, desperate to pull man and machine through the wet, clutching clay. Leaning far left against the fabric-covered fuselage, Charles Lindbergh peered through the open window and down Roosevelt Field's narrow runway. Not that there was much he could see on this drizzly Long Island morning. Shredded curtains of rain hung from low, heavy clouds, and he could barely see the tree line at the field's eastern edge. Despite being packed with cinders, the runway was soggy, and the damp sea-level air wasn't giving as much power to the right whirlwind JFC motor as it should. The tachometer, which measures engine revolutions per minute, showed 30 revolutions low. That worried him, as did the slight tailwind. Lindbergh had planned a sunrise takeoff facing into the easterly nighttime wind, but he was late. Now the breeze was from the west, and he either had to have the aircraft move to the other end of the runway or live with the problem. He could die from it, too. 3,610 miles to Paris, following 12 days after the Frenchmen Nungesser and Colley's doomed attempt at the Ortaig Prize in L'Oiseau Blanc. Lindbergh's flight was to be the first to try it nonstop and alone, and the first and only American attempt. Crowds had begun gathering at Roosevelt Field at midnight. Now a reported 500 stood expectantly in the rain, in the hope that they might see one of the great dramas of the air, wrote the New York Times' correspondent Russell Owen, who had made his name covering polar exploration. Like the conquest of the poles that a generation earlier had consumed the attention of the masses and made global celebrities of explorers like Peary, Shackleton, Mawson, Scott, and Amundsen, flying nonstop across the Atlantic had emerged as the signal quest of the time, emblematic of civilization's expanding limits. Lindbergh had served in the Army Air Service and was an experienced contract airmail pilot. In fact, it had been while flying the mail 11 months earlier that aviation's vast commercial potential became clear to the young pilot. In 1919, a kindred spirit, French-born American hotelier Raymond Ortig, proposed his eponymous prize for the first nonstop Paris to New York flight, hoping that in spurring pilots to win the prize money, aviation would be taken seriously and its technology advanced. 8 years later, Charles Lindbergh had drawn the attention of the world to this latest attempt to prove the world-shrinking possibilities of aviation. His maps were the best available, and he had planned the flight for a year, reviewing the route until he felt every detail was familiar. But he also understood the flight required an acceptance of the unknown. Something would happen. While others had crossed the Atlantic piecemeal or in airships, the pilot was aware that very few believed he, so young and unproven, possessed much of a chance. His backers in St. Louis had confidence, of course, as did his mother, Evangeline, in Detroit. Most importantly, he, Charles Augustus Lindbergh, believed it. Not that anyone outside of his rather insular world had ever heard of him before he'd shown up here on Long Island. It didn't matter. Inevitably known as Slim, the tall, lanky former mail pilot was committed now. To reduce stress on the undercarriage, his five fuel tanks had only been partially filled at neighboring Curtis Field, and then the aircraft had been towed nearly a mile across open country to Roosevelt Field. Fueling was finished at Roosevelt with bright red 5-gallon cans passed up to Ken Lane, Wright's aircraft's chief engineer. With one foot on the nose and another on the wing, Lane had carefully filtered the gas through a 200-mesh wire screen. Losing the engine somewhere over the North Atlantic due to a clogged fuel line was a nasty thought. Almost as bad as having it quit during a heavyweight takeoff with an audience in the rain. But that was the nature of flying, dangerous and unforgiving. Lindbergh's boots slipped a bit on the plain metal rudder pedals, as he hadn't thought to wipe them before squeezing into the narrow cockpit. With smooth foot movements, he walked the rudder, keeping the plane aligned along the runway's northern edge. But without a view forward, it wasn't easy. Slim had the main fuselage tanks moved forward of the cockpit, which was safer in the event of an accident. Lindbergh had seen too many pilots crushed or burned in crashes because they'd been sandwiched between fuel tanks and an engine. But this meant he had to use a 3-by-5-inch periscope to see straight ahead. There was no front window. His eyes darted inside again to the tachometer. If anything was subtly wrong with the engine, it would show here first. But the needle was steady at 1,825 revolutions. The plane skidded a bit, and as his heart skipped a beat, Slim's blue eyes flashed back to the runway's edge. I must hold the plane straight and not take my eyes from its edge for an instant. He wasn't moving fast enough to fly yet. Men were still running alongside the plane, their hands on the struts, pushing it through the muddy mess. His mechanic had actually greased the tires so they wouldn't stick as much, but he couldn't tell if it helped. The engine sounded muted, almost weak, compared to previous test flights and his trip here from the West Coast. Slim could feel the stick wobble in his hands, which wouldn't happen if enough air was passing over the control surfaces. Faster, he had to get the plane moving faster. It felt more like an overloaded truck than an airplane. built by Ryan Airlines in San Diego and named the Spirit of St. Louis. The plane was heavier than ever before. 450 gallons of California gasoline, complements of Standard Oil, produced a gross weight of 5,250 pounds. This was an astounding number, more than 2.5 tons, and though Lindbergh knew the J-5 Wright Whirlwind was theoretically capable of overcoming it, he'd never done it before. Lieutenant Commander Noel Davis and Lieutenant Stanton Wooster had tried a heavyweight takeoff 3 weeks earlier in Virginia. On April 26th, their Keystone Pathfinder American Legion, a full ton overweight, stalled on takeoff, and both died after smashing into a mud bank. Transocean flyers dogged by bad luck. All serious contenders here in Dash to Paris have met with reverses, some fatal, the New York Times had reported. Many tragedies recently. 13 deaths reported in this month alone. His face pale, Lindbergh stared from the little window, searching for a tiny white handkerchief he'd tied to a stick set in the ground. It was there as a warning. Half the runway was gone, and only 3,000 feet remained. He'd extrapolated a 2,250-foot takeoff distance from his test data, but that had been on a dry runway with a 7-knot headwind. What had he been thinking? Did he, Charles Lindbergh, possess some magical quality that the others before him lacked? They were certainly older than his 25 years and much more experienced. Why did he think he could succeed where they failed? Nearly a mile long, Roosevelt Field was the only choice for such an attempt, but was it even long enough? Yards from where he'd started, just off the runway's western edge, was an ugly, black, scorched area at the bottom of a ravine. A bent propeller blade was stuck upright in the middle of the burn, poignantly marking the crash of the last pilot who tried to reach Paris from New York. René Funk, the great French flying ace, had rumbled down this very runway 8 months ago in September, crashing an expensive aircraft and causing the horrible deaths of 2 crewmen. Lurching forward, the Spirit feels heavy and ungainly to the pilot. Lindbergh bounces in the wicker seat like riding in a buckboard wagon, and details jump out, mist hovering off the ground, mud slapping against the aircraft, blue violets clustered in the grass. But he felt a difference. At 300 feet down the runway, the plane is faster, and the last men have let go of the struts. Should he have waited? A takeoff seemed hopeless, Lindbergh would later write, and the wrong decision would mean a crash. Should he have waited another day or swallowed his pride and had the heavy aircraft towed around to the other end of Roosevelt Field? 1,000 feet down the runway now, and the stick is tighter. Slim feels air pressure pushing on the rudder through his boots. Spinning hard into the thick air, the propeller is trying to bite, to hold, and pull the Spirit into the sky. Is it enough? Will the wings take the heavy load before the 34-inch wire-spoked wheels snap? The handkerchief! A brief white speck flutters in the gray air, then vanishes into the mist. Halfway now, 3,000 feet down, and still not fast enough. He should have been airborne more than 500 feet back. Too much fuel? The extra 25 gallons added 153 pounds. Or is it the tailwind? Or the mushy runway? Too many variables. He knows that. He knows better. Lindbergh pulls the stick back an inch, and the wheels rise off the ground. But the Spirit immediately sinks back to the mud, hitting a puddle and splashing cold, dirty water along the cotton fabric fuselage. The wings wobble. His right hand and both feet play the stick and rudder to keep the plane straight. Lindbergh can feel the Spirit tremble, an animal crouched to spring. And then the right wing suddenly dips. Pull up! The wings level, now ease back to the runway, softly. A little rudder, and the plane settles. More splashes, and he feels the wheels slip in the mud. The roar fills the cockpit now as the engine churns out power, and his gloved fingers hold the throttle forward. It's like being inside a drum. The wheels lift off again, and he senses the ground falling away a few feet. I could probably stay in the air, but he doesn't. Letting the Spirit sink, Lindbergh feels the wheels mush again, but this time it's different, and the earth can't hold him down. The plane wants to fly. Sliding over the ground, controls taut, Slim feels all 223 horses throbbing through the stick. Staring through the silver spinning blades, Slim knows he's much too close to cut the power and far too fast now to stop. Does he have the speed to clear the wall of trees and telephone wires 1,000 feet up? Up, up! The propeller bites, wings lift, and the Spirit claws itself off the ground at 7:52 on that Friday morning. As the plane staggers slowly into the air, 25 feet high now, the trees are rushing up. So are the wires, shining in the rain like a spider web. 40 feet. The whirlwind's powerful growling thickens his hearing, and water droplets splatter across Lindbergh's goggles. No choice now but to fly or die. From the corner of his eye, the pilot glimpses a small knot of men at the end of the runway. The president of Ryan Airlines, B.F. Mahoney, and others are gathered around a big Lancia sedan, waiting with fire extinguishers, just in case. Suddenly, trees flash beneath the gleaming wet wheels, manicured grass, pale faces looking up. The golf course. He's over the links, past the east end of the airfield. But through the spinning 8-foot, 9-inch propeller, he sees another hill ahead. The stick trembles, and he knows the plane is telling him not to turn. There's not enough altitude to trade for airspeed, and not enough airspeed to maneuver. They're on the ragged edge of a stall, and his breathing quickens again. If he tries to avoid the hill, the Spirit will likely stall, and they'll spin in, just like Wooster and Davis. Tapping the rudder, Slim gently nudges the stick to the right. The aircraft answers ever so slightly, almost reluctantly, and they barely clear the hill. I'm above the trees. Lindbergh leaves New York at 7:52 a.m. With cool determination, he braves death to get off in the misty dawn, Russell Owen breathlessly reported to the Times' readers. Hundreds gasp as unconquerable youth Lindbergh, by sheer wizardry, lifts machine carrying 5,200-pound load with failure a few yards off. This was a portion of Chapter 1 of Dan Hampton's wonderful new book called The Flight, Charles Lindbergh's Daring and Immortal 1927 Transatlantic Crossing. The book is published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins. I'm Gregory Berg. And the time is 8:38. You are listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, and here's part two. We're spending this portion of WGTD's Morning Show talking about one of the most brilliant and also controversial innovators in recent history. Elon Musk is responsible for some of the most striking and remarkable innovations in several different industries. He has helped us explore space in ways we never did before. He has helped us develop electrical cars, and he has helped us rethink how we can use the internet. And it is difficult to think about a single person who has had quite so much effect on so many different facets of modern life. And yet by no means is he done. And in fact, in some ways, the most remarkable innovations of Elon Musk have not yet penetrated into the lives of ordinary citizens the way other sorts of innovations have. But in some respects, that day may be just around the corner. At any rate, he is a remarkable man with a really unprecedented career. And that career is explored in a really interesting new New York Times bestseller just out in paperback called Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. The book is written by Ashley Vance, who is a well-known author, and perhaps you know him as the host of Hello World, a technology travel television show. He writes extensively for Bloomberg Businessweek, and as a matter of fact, it was an assignment for them that first allowed him to cross paths with Mr. Musk, and that ended up being the germ for this very, very interesting book published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins, again called Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Ashley Vance, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell our listeners about that article that you wrote for Bloomberg Businessweek and the opportunity that it afforded you to pay your first visit to what you refer to as Musk Land.
Sure. Yeah, well, it dates back to 2012. You know, I live in Silicon Valley and was not really an Elon Musk believer. I cover a lot of technology companies here, but he had seemed like this guy who was always promising things but struggling to deliver on them. And then in 2012, some remarkable things happened. Tesla Motors, his electric car company, came out with this Model S sedan that became a huge hit. SpaceX, his space company, got to the International Space Station. And SolarCity, his solar company, filed for a public offering. And so I kind of dug in and decided to do a big story on him. And I found this guy was much more interesting and authentic and just had this fascinating life story that I hadn't expected. And that's really what set me off down this path.
You don't go into really lengthy detail about this, but you do say something to the effect that as you set about writing this book, you hoped for and did not at least immediately receive the kind of full cooperation from Mr. Musk that you had perhaps hoped. And yet he has not been an impediment in this project and indeed has become, it would seem, progressively more helpful, more open to you. Give us a sense of kind of the relationship that has developed between you, and in particular, what appears to be his deepening sense of trust in you with this project.
Yeah, well, it was a bit of a battle when I first did that cover story for Business Week about him. We had a fairly good rapport after that, and I floated the idea of doing a book. And you know, initially he said no, he wasn't going to cooperate with me, but he wasn't really going to get in my way. And so I spent about 18 months interviewing 200 people all who had worked at SpaceX and Tesla, and he also co-founded PayPal, so he's got this long history. And I sort of wore him down over time. You know, those 18 months passed, and he gave me a call and said he wanted to talk about maybe doing the book, but then he came with some pretty onerous terms. He's a very controlling figure. He worries about his image, and he wanted to be able to read the book before it came out and maybe put footnotes in it. And just as a journalist, I couldn't agree to do that. And so we had this big blowout meeting, and ultimately he agreed to do the book and just give me some interviews over the course of about 8 months, and I interviewed another 100 people. And then, yeah, he really opened up. We would have these long dinners, usually 3-4 hours once a month, and it was really the first time that I think anyone got to know the real man and to explore a lot of the ideas in depth that he's talked about. And then since then, things have been a little more tense. There were some things in the book that he didn't care for, and so we've had a bit of a battle in the months that have passed.
So, well, when we read about the kind of person he is and the way in which he has led his various companies, I suppose that tumultuousness should not come as much of a surprise. He has, of course, a very intriguing childhood. He was born and raised in South Africa, and it was a childhood that included a divorce and ultimately his decision to go live with his father. And you also describe how in some respects he was a bit of an outsider in his own land. How does he, that is Mr. Musk, view his own childhood? And how accurately do you think he views it in terms of the ways in which it shaped who he is and what he has accomplished?
Well, it's one of the more emotional topics for him. As you mentioned, his parents divorced. He went to live with his father. He had a very difficult relationship with his dad and his mother. His dad was quite hard on him. As a kid, it's really funny. I went back and I interviewed tons of schoolmates that he had over the years, and they all said he was kind of the least likely person that they would have expected to do all this stuff. He was a loner. He was a little bit weird. It's a very masculine sport. sports heavy culture, and he was the kid who liked to sit in the corner and read books. He read 1 to 2 books every day and devoured science fiction in particular. And so he was either being left alone or he was being bullied, and he had a couple incidents that were quite bad. He got kicked down a flight of stairs one time and had to go to the hospital for about a week after that incident. And I think he reflects on his childhood, from what I can tell, pretty accurately. These incidents had a huge impact on him, and I think, you know, just playing sort of armchair psychologist for a little bit, he's part of this quest that he has been on, that I talk about in the book, has been to prove to everybody that they were wrong, that he was this very special kid, and that he had big things to accomplish, and so it's been a huge chip on his shoulder throughout his whole life.
Right. Some words that leapt off the page when you described what a compulsive reader he was, and how he especially would read himself to sleep with 2 different sets of encyclopedias. That happens to be something I did in my own childhood. But of course, that in and of itself doesn't mean you're destined for the kind of greatness that he has achieved. He ultimately moves to Canada in kind of an impulsive move, and ultimately crosses the border to the United States to go to college, which had been a long-held dream. One of the things that you say about him that's, I think, quite intriguing is the way in which he really goes out of his way to insist that many of his most important ideas involving space travel or solar power and some of the other innovations he has developed, he insists that he already had these ideas while he was a young college student. And you have kind of an interesting analysis of why he insists on that particular narrative. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that you picked up on. I always found it fascinating that he would talk at such length about how he had architected this vision for his life from such a young age. And I think he doesn't want to be seen as the typical Silicon Valley guy, definitely not a venture capitalist who's just looking for the next opportunity to dump money into and make a ton of cash. He's tried to portray this picture of him that he's not some money-hungry individual, that he's actually been thinking about these bigger things for mankind all along. People should know that his major quest in life is to set up a colony on Mars because he fears that the human species may be wiped out by some strange event here on Earth, and so he wants to create a backup plan for people. When you look at Tesla and Solar City, they're obvious attempts to try and curb global warming, and so he comes wrapped with these grand missions that he's been chasing after. And so, yeah, he did not want to be seen as just your regular Silicon Valley story of some guy trying to get rich quick, that he's actually got this very purposeful life. And then, you know, part of it, I think, is him. It is true. All of this is true. And I do not think that he's driven by money in the same way that a lot of the people here are. But you also see him consciously shaping his image from a pretty early day.
Right. And of course, by suggesting that he had many of these early ideas when hardly anybody else was thinking about these ideas, gives those ideas, in a sense, even another layer of grandeur by making them ideas far before their time, in a sense. He's not just the typical guy who comes along and builds on someone else's great idea and makes it even better. He really wants us to think of many of these ideas as ideas that he came up with a long, 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 long time ago.
Absolutely. And there's some pretty funny stuff to back this up. You know, he's in Canada, where he first started out at university, and he always struggled to get dates because he was a bit of a loner nerd, to be frank. And there's one where his mom sets him up on a date with this very pretty girl, and she comes over for his birthday party. I think it was his 18th birthday party, and they sit down on the couch, and he basically immediately says hello. She says hello back, and then he says, "Have you ever thought about electric cars?" and I interviewed her about this, and she just thought it was the most peculiar thing that had ever come out of some suitor's mouth before. And so, you know, this is still how he kind of is today.
Mm-hmm. So when you describe the first of his many startups, which is something with his own brother, a company called Zip2, you describe some of the troubles that he has in terms of leading other people. And, of course, this is one thing that has been a hallmark of his career, is the fact that he is not an easy person to work with, and he tends to have rather volatile relationships with everybody with whom he works. And he, in explaining this, mentions the fact that, you know, he until this time, he had never been so much as the co-captain of a sports team or in school or anything. He'd never had to lead anybody before. So he has had to try to learn from his own mistakes, and to some extent he has, and to some extent it sounds like he has not, that he continues to struggle with this particular facet of his professional life.
Yeah, well, in his early days, so there's Zip2, and then his next company is PayPal, and you see this guy who's trying to emerge from that youth of always being off on his own and not really having many social skills. And so he comes into these companies, and he's just brutally honest with people in meetings. Some engineer would present something, and he'd just say, "You're wrong." But not only that, he would dig into the guy and be like, "Why are you so stupid? Why would you present this in front of us?" And leave the guy in tears in front of all of his peers. And by the way,
I remember you mentioning that one of the things that would really set him off is if someone, if he would ask somebody in such a meeting, well, why are we doing that? He said, "Well, that's what we've always done." And those words would just be like the worst possible answer one could give to such a question. I mean, that's
absolutely
the worst reason to do something is that's the way we've always done it, and that someone might get fired for saying those words.
Yeah, quite often. And you know, in these first couple of companies, things go okay for a while, and then ultimately he gets either pushed to the side as CEO or thrown out of the company, and so it ends really badly for him. Over time, he's gotten a lot better. I mean, certainly you see him up on stage now addressing thousands of people, and he's much more confident than he used to be, and he's evolved. But Tesla and SpaceX are notorious today in Silicon Valley for being these incredibly hard-charging places where he still will lay into employees when needed, but you know, to his credit, one of the best things about him and the reason that he's a success is that he's able to marshal these thousands of engineers to get behind him and to chase after these projects. And so he's clearly developed a way to tame some of these more fearful sides of him enough to push people on.
Right. Of course, what really makes him extraordinary is the way in which he has sought to reshape entire industries in a way that not many human beings have managed to accomplish. For instance, when it comes to, in a sense, reshaping the space industry, a business which he felt, in your words, had not really evolved in about 50 years. One of the ways in which you help us understand his ideas is by talking about Ferraris and Honda Accords, of all things. Explain how this, in a sense, symbolizes his radical new ideas about how the space industry should function.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people don't follow this stuff closely, but basically what had happened is you had the space industry starts to get developed during the 60s and really doesn't change much at all. The rockets are all made by nations, the United States, Russia, China, and they're all designed to minimize failure. And so they're building the Ferraris of rockets, things that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. They're guaranteed not to blow up. And he came in with a sort of different idea, which was, I want to become the Southwest of space. That was SpaceX's motto in its early days when it started around 2002. He wanted to create much cheaper rockets that could go to space much more often. He had a theory that there was a lot of waste in the industry, that things like electronics and software had improved dramatically over the decades, and that this industry needed a reboot. A lot of people had sort of similar ideas. Billionaires had tried to get into space and failed pretty spectacularly. And Elon is the first guy who's managed to pull off private space. And really, for people who don't follow this, the United States had lost all competitiveness in this field as far as expensive, and today SpaceX is the low-cost way to get something into space, and he's brought thousands of jobs back to the United States. It's, for me, the most inspirational story around him, and you know, if you're into this sort of thing, it's a very patriotic story.
Absolutely. And, of course, what he has accomplished with Tesla is quite extraordinary as well, despite some really, really difficult early days with what you describe at one point as a spending horror show from which he eventually emerges. As I indicated in the introduction, we are talking about a great innovator who nevertheless has not penetrated the everyday lives of normal Americans the way some other people have. At one point you write, Musk has yet to have a consumer hit on the order of the iPhone or to talk to a billion people on Facebook. For the most part, he is still making rich people's toys. How far are we from Elon Musk turning the corner and going beyond that?
We're getting a little closer now. Something like SpaceX is probably never going to enter the consumer consciousness, although we see it on television a lot more now when they have a successful launch, and it has started this whole new space movement to get some attention. For Tesla, they have been producing these cars that tend to cost about $100,000 each, and here where I live in Silicon Valley, they're all over the place, but certainly not a mainstream vehicle. It's this year when finally, after about 15 years, that Tesla may have its moment. The company hopes to come out with a $35,000 car called the Model 3, and it's this vehicle that will either make or break the company and probably a lot of Elon's legacy. If he can produce this car on time and keep the company alive, it's still always in a huge cash crunch, then this really is his iPhone moment, because Tesla has this huge shining brand, and this car would be the most advanced car on the road. And yeah, I mean, this is kind of what we've all been waiting for.
Right. Last quick question. You say at one point that Elon Musk is more of a Thomas Edison than a Howard Hughes. Explain why we should think of him in those terms.
Yeah, he's certainly done a bunch of industries like Howard Hughes has, but to me, it goes back to the point we talked about before. You know, the most remarkable thing about him is that he has taken thousands and thousands of the world's smartest people, in much the same way Edison had these invention factories, and pulled the most out of them and invented a string of incredible technologies that are behind these companies. And so, you know, this is the best thing about him, is that he's able to give people a sense of mission, to give them the tools they need to go off and invent these things. And so this is why I put him in that category.
Mm. The book, again, is by Ashley Vance, is Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future, published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins, now available in paperback. Ashley Vance, congratulations on a really interesting book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thanks so much, and thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Here's what's coming up in the remainder of the week on The Morning Show here on WGTD. Tomorrow, I speak with Dr. Yuri Maltsev from the economics faculty at Carthage College. Dr. Maltsev will be appraising the presidency of Donald Trump thus far from a conservative perspective. Later in the week, on Friday, I'll be speaking with Dr. Jerry Mast from the political science department at Carthage, who will be offering his own analysis from his own perspective. Also this week, on Wednesday, you'll hear my interview with Simon Sebag Montefiore, who has crafted a sprawling and fascinating history of the Romanovs, the family that ruled Russia from 1613 until the murder of the last Tsar in 1918. It is a fascinating